It's a great pleasure to be back here so soon. same idea, how to visualize the electronic structure, but now today I want to talk about the reality of the impact of the dopant process and the lattice on the electronic structure in the cube rate as detected precisely at the atomic scale. Again, this is in collaboration with Professor Uchida, Dr. Esaki, key Japanese colleagues, and Dr. Kazu Fujita, this is the same person. He's in a linear superposition between Tokyo and Cornell, and that's a very tiring job. And graduate students James Slezak, Alfred Wang, Jin-Ho Lee, and former colleague Kyle McElroy. Now I want to give some context with respect to using cold atoms to explore beautiful and exotic Hamiltonians for bosons and fermions and anions, etc. Those are fabulous opportunities for physics. But high TC cube rates are real materials. You can buy them by the kilogram, and they have a real potential purpose in the future. And of course, the purpose is to have lossless electrical transmission, electromagnetic transmission, lossless laptops, lossless everything eventually. But for that, of course, we need the TC to be above room temperature. And it's just almost about halfway to room temperature now. Now here's the famous graph of TC of low TC conventional electron phonon superconductors. MgB2 isn't on here. It would be right about there. And then in the late 80s, TC began to shoot up very rapidly. And if I hadn't put this line on here, it would imply that this curve was going to keep going. But of course it didn't. For more than 10 years, TC has not increased. Now, suppose for the sake of argument, we knew the correct theory for the electronic structure of the CuO2 plane. Let's suppose it's the TJ model. You take all the facts you know about a given piece of material, you plug them into your model, and you predict TC. If that theory existed, then we would know, is it a crazy idea to keep working for another 25 years to get up to room temperature, or can it never work? But because that theory doesn't exist in a quantitative sense, we don't know. Should we keep going? Is there a key to this mystery? Or is this just all irrelevant and futile? As one of my...
Before that, yeah. Dot appeared, we had a theory that told us it was impossible.
Right. Indeed.
So good.
Well, the context here is I want to introduce a whole bunch of other physical phenomena and effects which are not trivial with respect to the issue of driving up TC, even though they may not be some elegant Hamiltonian or ground state. And these effects are very important for the ultimate application of the high TC superconducting materials. So I'm going to remind you about the octahedron. Then I'll tell you a little bit about lattice interactions and tunneling spectroscopy. That has a glorious history. Remind you very quickly of our technique. Then I'm going to tell you about how the nanoscale electronic disorder is related to the dopant process that you must use to make cuprates into high TC superconductors. Then I'm going to tell you a very interesting effect just recently discovered in the last few months of how varying the geometry of the CuO6 alters the superconductivity locally inside that unit cell. And then finally, I'll tell you about how to visualize the electron boson interactions and what they do to the superconductivity. Please stop me and ask questions. So here are the two sets of orbitals I mentioned yesterday, the in-plane p and d orbital, and this is the out-of-plane p and d orbital. And this is the one which, at least in my opinion, is playing the primary role in the discussions we're going to have today. We know the out-of-plane effects are important. I emphasize that. A trivial reason to know this is that at the same doping and for the same physical structure of the CuO2 plane, the TC of monolayer materials can vary by a factor of order 20. So it's a logical deduction from that fact that there's at least one other key degree of freedom in the cuprate problem. It doesn't have to be key in terms of the fundamental Hamiltonian, of course. It could be key in the sense that it's destructive, but you still have to identify what it is. Now, we know that the out-of-plane effects are geometrical in nature. This has been known for a long time, but not widely acknowledged, I think. And here's how the fabulous material scientists can figure this out. You take a sequence of monolayer cuprates, and you can substitute on this site, which is right next to this apical oxygen atom. You can substitute an atom at that location, which has the same valence as the one which was there previously. You don't introduce a Coulomb scattering process. And it doesn't involve changing the carrier density in the CuO2 plane. You don't alter the hole density. But you can drive TC all the way from its maximum down to zero, or in some systems you can drive it up from zero and back down again rather rapidly. These are geometrical effects having to do with the displacement of this atom and perhaps other atoms in the next layer nearby the CuO2 plane. Okay, now a teeny bit of history. So here's our BCS ground state, and here's our BCS excited states, the Bogoliubov quasiparticles. Here's the density of states we would expect in an S-wave superconductor at zero temperature. We can measure this by using tunneling spectroscopy, and we should see something like this. There are no states within plus or minus delta of the Fermi energy. Indeed, you can do that measurement. Javer did it 45 years ago. So here's the differential conductance between a normal tunnel barrier and superconductor. This is published in one of his first papers. And here you see the gap very beautifully and the singularity in the density of states at the edge. So this tunneling is a fabulous tool for seeing the formation of this S-wave superconductor. A very interesting thing about this graph, though, is that it contains one other profoundly important thing. It's over here. These are steps in the density of states, in the differential conductance. And they occur at energies which can be labeled. The total energy is the gap energy plus some other energy. For this one, it's the gap energy plus another energy. What these are is the signature of the electron-phonon coupling in the conventional superconductor. You can go back to the Elie-Ashberg scheme and then Scalapino and colleagues working out how the electron-phonon coupling would produce its signature in the density of states in the differential conductance. These objects, so this is what the theory would show. This is from Doug's book. This is density of states as a function of energy. This energy here is the gap energy plus the phonon energy. And at that point, there's this characteristic feature. And here it is in reality. So what I'm trying to tell you here is you can not only measure the gap energy, but in conventional materials, you could measure the phonon energy. And actually, you can even measure the electron-phonon coupling constant and predict TC if you have some Dynes or Macmillan style equation. Okay, so here is the tool we use. We study mostly this material today, BISCO. We break it at the bismuth oxide layer. Here's the CuO2 plate. Now look at this picture carefully. We will need to keep this in mind a little bit. Each dot here is a bismuth atom, one of these guys, and underneath it is the copper atom. Now, this is a topographic image. It's a graph whose contrast represents elevation. So, in fact, if I were to draw a line, let's say this way, so you can all see these vertical striations. If I were to draw a line this way, the graph of the elevation of the surface is basically a sine wave. But it's an incommensurate sine wave. It's about 26 angstroms. Periodicity. That's called a supermodulation. It's there because the natural unit cell of bismuth oxide is different than the natural unit cell dimension of copper oxide. So in order to get the two sheets to go together, the system buckles periodically. This is not a surface effect. This is a bulk effect. This same modulation exists in every layer throughout the crystal. I mean, not the same amplitude, but the same physical phenomenon exists in every layer throughout the crystal. You can know that from X-ray studies. So this is called the incommensurate crystal supermodulation. And what's happening is that the unit cell dimensions are modulating.
Are those dollar signs intrinsic?
So they're probably a surface effect. You don't see those in X-ray. If you try to do the X-ray, what do they call it? Not reconstruction.
Why in X-ray is not seen in them?
Pardon?
Why it is not seen in X-ray?
Because this is a surface effect, and X-ray is a bulk probe. Yeah. Here, this appears to be as if one of the bismuth atoms pops out of what its bulk position would be because you have terminated the surface.
Probably it was seen on electron defect.
Yes, it was. Quite correct. Here's our spectrum. Tunnel into, choose a good atom, let's say here, that atom there on this surface. Tunnel in there and you'll see this. As I said, this is a nice D-wave spectrum. There's the node. There's the singularity at the gap maximum. So this spectrum is consistent with a nodal D-wave superconductor. That's great. But I think you've all noticed these guys out here. I've looked back through the literature. At least 17 years ago, those two guys were reported for the first time. They're particle hole symmetric features, and they're outside the gap. They are at E greater than delta. You can find them in studies from all different groups. They certainly would not be there in textbook D-wave case. But of course, if you had an electron boson interaction, it will produce a signature at delta plus omega, where omega is the energy of the boson. All right, so first thing I want to talk about is local effects, atomic scale effects, on the superconductivity due to the randomness of the dopant atoms. These materials are ionic insulators. You can't make them into a superconductor, at least in a bulk crystal, unless you have a large concentration of dopant atoms. About one every, say, 3 by 3 unit cell plaquettes. So here is one of our maps of the density of states. It's relatively homogeneous at these high energies up here. And then when we approach these energies, as I showed you, it becomes horribly heterogeneous at the 3 nanometer scale.
This is superconducting.
This is superconducting, yeah.
Is it possible to measure the same in normal?
It's the same in the normal state. The superconducting coherence disappears, but this electronic structure at the zone phase is the same in the normal state. Okay. Ah, but there may be no normal state in a CuO2 system. The normal state is not a Fermi liquid or a piece of metal. Mm-hmm. It may be a phase incoherent superconductor, for example. Okay. Now, you can take one of these data sets and measure the gap, just the peak-to-peak gap at every location, and it varies widely on the 3 nanometer scale. And you can measure the doping dependence, reduce the hold, the carrier density, and this disorder survives at all dopings. Of course, the mean value of the gap is rising steadily from 10 millivolts up to above 65 millivolts. So electronic structure is evolving rapidly, but look at the disorder. The disorder doesn't seem to be that different. And with these new fitting techniques now, we can prove that statistically, the statistical properties of the disorder are the same at all dopings. So there's something triggering this disorder, and it's probably, I mean, Occam's razor would say whatever that something is, it's the same thing at all dopings. Now, what could be the source of this nanoscale electronic disorder? Well, one possibility is that our colleagues just left too many impurity atoms in the sample. So, for example, if there were zinc atoms in there, each one has its own unitary resonance. You can find it by imaging at the resonance energy. That's what it looks like. Or nickel atoms in there, each one has a non-unitary resonance, but a pretty strong resonance at a different energy. You can find all of those. So are there strongly scattering impurity atoms in the CuO2 plane here? Well, we just take a simultaneous image of the low energy electronic structure, and the answer is no. There are only 7 unitary scatterers in this field of view. I don't think it's physically possible to imagine that all of this disorder came from those small population of impurity atoms. So what other population? Well, of course, the other population would be the dopant atoms. So in the BISCO material, when the sample is formed, the dopant atoms are non-stoichiometric oxygen atoms, and they end up somewhere near the bismuth oxide layer. I think either just a little bit underneath the bismuth oxide layer. And of course, it has always been proposed that nearby each dopant atom, there would be some damage to the electronic structure. That was proposed within 1 year of the discovery of HITC. So we wanted to search for the dopant atoms. They're in the O2 minus state in BISCO. And we were searching, of course, by tunneling spectroscopy, looking at this layer. Here is the density of states as a function of energy. Here, now we see most of the band. And here we see the superconductivity. And most of the spectra look like this. But every now and then you can find one that looks like this. There's a big peak near minus 1 volt. Minus 1 volt isn't crazy. You have a negatively charged dopant atom. That means you have more filled states below the Fermi energy. But we can now go to a crystal, take a topographic image, and take an image at near minus 1 volt. These are simultaneous. And we see a population of what we believe are the dopant atoms. These are the atoms which have captured the electrons from the CuO2 plane and generated the superconductivity. We can count the density of these dopant atoms as we alter the whole density of the material. And indeed, the populations go ahead at the correct rate. It looks like there's another population, a smaller population of dopant atoms in this material, because the slope of this count as a function of the whole density doesn't go through zero. So there's another population in the crystal. But these guys are changing with the correct density to be the oxygen dopant atoms. Now, do they cause the disorder? So here's one of those maps of the energy gap, 20 millivolts, 70 millivolts. This is a slightly underdoped sample. Here's the simultaneous map of the proposed dopant atoms. So I guess I should say, these obviously are not pictures of atoms. These are pictures of an impurity state, which is generated by putting the dopant atom into the crystal somewhere. So we can write the location of each one of these objects, and then write down that location simultaneously with the electronic disorder. And now you can ask yourself, could this population of randomly, and they are randomly distributed, Poisson random with an exclusion zone, could they be the cause of the electronic disorder? Actually, the answer is yes. Look at these low gap regions, these light colored regions. The probability to find a dopant atom in those regions, there's a contradiction, but elsewhere, it's very low. And look at these high gap regions. The probability to find a dopant atom there is very high. You can do the statistics. This is the correlation between the population of dopant atoms and the gap. And it has got a strong positive correlation. They are well correlated with each other. So that gives a priori evidence that this population of impurity states, whose density varies as you vary the number of dopant atoms, is indeed producing some large fraction of this electronic disorder.
What in-plane correlation, the coherence lengths here?
These are Poisson random, but the inter-dopant distance is about 1.4 nanometers, and the correlation length of the gap disorder is longer than that, almost twice as long.
And the coherence length in play.
Of the superconductor?
Yeah.
About 10 angstroms.
Only 10 angstroms?
Maybe 7. Maybe actually 4 angstroms. Might be just one unit set.
No, we have to write it.
Yeah. No. I mean, if you try to damage the order parameter directly by putting a vortex core or a zinc atom, what is the distance scale over which it can recover? 7 to 10 angstroms. Yeah.
Oxygens are donating holes.
Yeah, I don't believe in holes. Yes. So they capture electrons.
They capture,
yes.
Right.
Okay.
As you dope, in the conventional sense, more doping, more. So the density is going up.
It's true, but in the range that I showed you here between, say, 10% and 22%, you've doubled the density. The interparticle distance has only changed by the square root of 2. So that is not a huge effect.
What's the strange to me is the region where you have a lot of the impurity, you have the high gap state.
Yeah.
Which is what you see more of as you go towards that filling.
Sure. These are not impurities. These are dopant atoms. Okay, you're quite correct. I'm going to come back to that point in a second. It was one of the biggest surprises of this study that nearby these negatively charged objects, one might have guessed that you would have accumulated in some holes and gone farther away from half filling, which would have driven the gap down. But the opposite is what occurs. And I'm going to give an argument, which we should discuss, about that there's a different mechanism going on here. That's not the primary effect. We can look at the coherence peaks of the superconductor, just look at the height of the coherence peak and use it as a measure of how good is the D-wave superconductivity. That's what the contrast is here. These are nice droplets of super-duper D-wave superconductivity. And here you see very clearly that the clusters of the dopant atoms are pushing the coherence peaks down, and you can see that by direct observation. These guys are far from where the dopant atoms are. And so by these guys, I mean, let's say, this red spectrum. That's what you see far from the dopant atom. These guys, let's say this blue or black spectrum, is what you see in one of these clusters of dopant atoms. Now look at this curve. This is not consistent with the idea of, let's say, scattering by dopant atoms is the cause of the problem. Because scattering, let's say, Abrakosov-Gorkov, would take the spectral weight from the coherence peaks and it would fill in the density of states at the Fermi energy. But it's diametrically the opposite thing that happens. You take the spectral weight from the coherence peaks and you send it back out here to half a volt or more away from the Fermi energy. This is a completely different mechanism than the traditional Abrakosov-Gorkov mechanism.
May I ask you about the statistics of impurities?
Yes.
Oh, not impurities, sorry.
Dopants. Thank you.
Did you study, is it Poisson
random? It's Poisson random, but there's an exclusion zone. They don't come within a certain distance of each other. Okay, that's... It looks like what you would expect when they were just diffused in there at some high temperature, which is how the crystal was formed. So there are two important conclusions here. One is that the same dopant atoms that give you the high TC superconductor that are your promise for the future, they damage it quite severely at the atomic scale. Of course, this has been known from bulk studies. YBCO is a much more electronically homogeneous material, and its dopant process involves an atom which is farther away from the CuO2 plane. But the other interesting thing is that the damage mechanism I showed you here implies that the pairing, let's assume that this cluster of dopant atoms has done something bad to the pairing mechanism. But then it implies that the pairing mechanism involves mainly the high energy states at the atomic scale. Very different than BCS. Now, the mechanism whereby these effects could actually occur, following on from Leon's question, is under discussion. One thing we know is that the anti-correlation really rules out the dopant-induced hole density variations. There should be more holes here, so the gap value should be smaller, but the opposite is what's observed. One of the proposals is that it's a geometrical effect. When you put the dopant atom, here's the dopant atom, this is the work by Peter Hirschfeld and colleagues. You do models, put the dopant atom at this location and try to find out what happens in the crystal. The biggest motion is that the apical oxygen atom moves off to one side. So instead of a dopant-induced, instead of a hole density variation, let's suppose it's a geometrical variation which is causing the electronic disorder. Now I gave you a reason yesterday why that could happen. There's a very delicate hybridization between the orbitals on the copper atom and the oxygen atom above, both in the D manifold and in the 4S manifold. You're going to move this object by a significant fraction of the dimension of the unit cell. And you can alter the electronic structure here very, very strongly. You can move the energy levels of the x squared minus y squared, of the other high D orbital, and of the P orbitals, all relative to each other. But your TJ model is delicately dependent on having the hopping rate and the effective Hubbard U be unperturbed. So you can have a high energy perturbation here to a correlated model of superconductivity through a geometrical effect. And this is the same point. The mechanism is obviously a reorganization of the electronic structure at high energy, not a scattering process. Okay, now let's turn to part B. Real 2. So I want to talk about a local effect on the superconductivity now of varying the unit cell dimension. So here's the ultimate out-of-plane Gedanken experiment. I have a machine whereby I can take the unit cell with a particular geometry, and then I detect what it did to the pairing process within that unit cell. And now I turn a knob and I get a different geometry for my unit cell, and I detect what happened within inside that unit cell, and so on and so on and so on. That's the Gedanken experiment you would like to do to find out if there's local superconductivity governed by the geometry of the unit cell. Now, here's another one of these maps of the energy gap. Variations are huge. I've been talking to you about the random disorder, which is coming from the random distribution of the dopant atoms. But now look carefully at this map. It also has a periodic modulation, or a quasi-periodic modulation. Can anyone see it? Yeah, exactly. Your eye is going to tell you there's a sequence of parallel objects along this axis. And they're a weak but periodic modulation upon which is imposed a strong but random effect. Here's the simultaneous picture of the crystal. Indeed, it has its crystalline supermodulation on the same axis. Well, now that's what we want to pursue.
How did you get this supermodulation?
It comes as a natural part of this material.
Just near the surface, yeah?
No, the supermodulation is a bulk property of these materials. In order to make the crystal, to minimize the free energy density of the formation of the crystal, it's better to have a modulation of the unit cell as a function of distance in this family of materials. And it's a three-dimensional bulk property. Here you see a picture of the top surface of that bulk modulation. Okay. Pardon? I'll come to that. Good question. Yeah. Now, is this effect here at all dopings? Well, once you've learned how to look for it, it just glares at you. It's there in every single map that we or anybody else has ever published. You see these parallel lines. You take the Fourier transform. You'll see that there are two pairs of spots. But these are maps of the superconducting energy gap. So there is a quasi-periodic modulation of the energy gap at all dopings in this group. And indeed, you can see by eye that it actually follows the crystal supermodulation. So what is this supermodulation? It's a redistribution. It's a perturbation away from the ideal location of each atom in the three-dimensional unit cell. The X-ray studies of this are really beautifully detailed. It would take hours to describe how each atom is perturbed. So here's a simple abstraction of what we're interested in. In BISCO, at the maximum, let's go back now, you see these white colored regions here with this additional perturbation? They're the maximum of the surface displacement towards you. See these dark regions? They're the minimum. They're the trough of the surface displacement. Okay, so at the maximum of the surface displacement, it appears a little bit counterintuitive, but that's when the distance of the apical to the copper atom is minimized. And the reason why that happens is the CuO2 plane is also modulating underneath. So at the maximum of the supermodulation, we have the minimum of the apical distance, and at the minimum of the supermodulation, we have maximal apical distance. And this happens in 26 angstroms. We have about enough for 4 or 5 unit cells. And the displacement of this atom is about 0.2 angstroms. It's 10% of the unit cell dimension, which is a big effect. So this Gedanken experiment is not a Gedanken experiment. You can do it because Mother Nature has given you all this distribution of unit cell sizes. Now, there are some problems, though. This thing is not periodic. It has all kinds of defects and phase slips in it. So you can't just take the Fourier transform of your data and write down the answer. It's the spatial phase of this modulation is disordered. So here's some raw data. You just take a cut through our knowledge of where the top surface is, and you see it does have a periodicity, but it's too disordered to be certain what each unit cell dimension is. So what we want to do is we want to find a technique to label each atom here according to what the dimension of the unit cell is underneath. And you can do that. You take basically a lock-in technique. First of all, you take your geometrical information, filter, then multiply by sine and cosine. That will give you the phase of that, the spatial phase at every location. Then go back to your modulated, your carrier frequency, your sine and cosine, and that'll give you a map of the phase of the modulation at every location. So, and that's what this map is. You see, it is disordered. Now, what does that mean? Phase zero we define to be the maximum of the displacement. And
phi.
Pardon?
What is phi?
Phi is the spatial phase of the sine or cosine. So the modulation has cosine kx plus phi. That's what it is, phi. So phi equals zero we designate to be the maximum of the supermodulation, and phi equals 180 we designate to be the minimum. And these are real fits, so you can see it works very well. It tracks those maxima and minima very beautifully with high precision. Okay, so now we can sort all of our spectroscopic data according to this phase. So here we are in the supermodulation phase. This is minimal apical distance, maximum apical distance, minimal apical distance. And here's the distribution of gap values, and there is some distribution at every value of the phase, but you can see clearly that the gap magnitude is modulated by the unit cell dimension. And this is true at all dopings. We can extract the average of this thing, and we see that the superconducting energy gap varies with the unit cell dimension, and it does so at all dopings. Okay. There's a misprint here. So there's a sine-like modulation in the gap energy, and the range here is about 50 to 45, so 5 or 6 millivolts range. So the conclusion is that the gap energy is modulated by 10% due to variations in the unit cell geometry. And this modulation is more or less independent of doping. It's 9 or 10% for a wide range of dopings. Now, one thing we were very worried about, we know that the dopant atom causes a variation in the energy gap. So one possibility is that the distribution of dopant atoms is modulated by the crystal modulation and just imprinting itself on the energy gap. There are more dopants in this direction. So could the dopant density be the cause of this effect? Well, we can measure this phase of the crystalline modulation, locate each dopant atom with respect to the maximum or minimum of that modulation, and then build a histogram for what's the probability of finding a dopant atom near the maximum of the supermodulation, the minimum, or the maximum. But this distribution has the wrong period. It has doubled the spatial period of the effect that we found. So it cannot be the cause of the variation in the gap energy with the crystal. So here's a summary. If you take this random distribution of dopant atoms, you get reasonably well correlated a random distribution of gap energy. If you take this periodic modulation of the unit cell dimension and impose it, imagine that it's imposed in parallel, you get a weaker modulation of the superconducting energy gap, but closely, very closely tied to the geometry of the unit cell. Now, one thing we just found out really in the last month or so is that if we measure the gap value as a function of distance from the dopant atom, the gap value decays very nicely as a function of distance. So near the dopant atom, the gap value is high. And by the time you get 20 angstroms away, the gap value has fallen by almost 10 millivolts. Near the apical oxygen atom, the gap value is high. And when the apical oxygen is farther away, you get a lower gap value. So now we're pursuing the hypothesis that there's the same microscopic mechanism, but it is not the alteration of the carrier density. It's a geometrical effect, which is altering the high energy electronic structure. The two experiments could you can sort the data and show that the same phenomena are occurring in both cases.
I should not be worried about the fact that this thing is not symmetric around zero.
I think the precision of the definition of the zero of phase is not that high. Good question. Yeah, I can show you the statistics for all the different fits. So now we're pursuing the idea that there is a big out. So why is this interesting? These are large changes. If the gap value changes from 40 to 50 millivolts and it was a BCS superconductor, then TC could be changing from 400 to 500 Kelvin. These are not trivial effects when it comes to trying to drive TC up towards room temperature. They could be very serious effects. And that's what the material scientists have been pursuing now for the last number of years. But here we see at the atomic scale that these effects really exist. Okay, part three. But a related issue having to do with the interaction of the high TC superconductivity with the crystal. Now here's the traditional picture of superconductivity. You have a retarded effect which involves the exchange of a pairing boson. In conventional superconductors, that would be a phonon. We know that this can support superconductivity up to above 40 Kelvin because of MgB2. Now here's a very interesting paper from Phil Anderson at Princeton. Just came out about 3 or 4 months ago. And it basically is pointing out, he says, you know, do we need or want a bosonic glue, this object, to pair the electrons for high TC superconductors? And his conclusion is, in this paper we point out that the picture of boson exchange is a folklore description of the pairing process with no rigorous basis. And he argues that one should not pursue the search for such a boson involved in the mechanism of high TC. That may indeed be true, but there are very large changes in the self-energy of the CuO2 plane electrons occurring at some characteristic energy between 50 and 60 millivolts below the Fermi energy as detected by photoemission. This is a classic signature of a strong electron boson interaction. The Green's function for the quasiparticle gets renormalized by the interaction with some boson. And this has been studied by a wide variety of groups over the last 10 years. It's a very, very widely accepted phenomenon and a robust effect. Now, it could be that one should not pursue it because we don't need or want a bosonic glue, but there is still something extremely interesting here. And it has been pursued in the context either of the interaction of the electrons with lattice vibration modes, these groups, or the interaction of the electrons with the residual spin density wave modes which are in the material after the antiferromagnetic insulator is destroyed by doping. And one would at least like to distinguish between these two cases. That would be a step forward. Here's a paper by Lanzara and Shen from 2001 where they showed that this mode has little or no doping dependence, whereas we know that the magnetic structure has a rapid, the spin density wave modes depend rather strongly on dopant density. And so they argued that there is evidence for a electron phonon coupling. And this paper really stimulated a very intense 5 years of research, which for any of you who want to read the history is summarized in some of these papers. Now, we would like to take a look at that situation. If there is an electron-boson interaction in tunneling spectroscopy, as I pointed out to you in the context of Javer's original studies, it would appear out here at energies larger than the gap energy. In fact, it would appear at the gap energy plus the energy of that boson, if such boson existed. So we would like to study the electronic structure in this energy range. So here's my previous point. In conventional superconductors, you do see these steps outside the gap, and they occur at the gap energy plus the boson energy. Macmillan and Roll and other workers use, instead of using the differential conductance, they use the next derivative, because for these shallow steps, the next derivative produces a nice peak. This is just an experimental way of bringing out this effect. Now suppose in these tunneling spectra there is an electron-boson coupling signature. It would be a peak in the next derivative, d2i dv squared. That was my point here. The phonon is a peak in d2i dv squared. It would be a peak in d2i dv squared, and it would occur at an energy delta plus omega. Now the difficulty in exploring that issue in these materials is that delta itself is horribly disordered. It isn't something, this peak cannot occur at a fixed energy. If it exists, it's horribly disordered because delta is itself horribly is very disordered. So to find any boson energy, we need to know the energy of the peak in d2i dv squared and the value of delta at every location. That's the experimental challenge. So we have been developing technology which is involved in measuring the electronic structure very efficiently with atomic resolution in very short periods of time now. We can measure DIDV completely in about 12 hours. To keep the same signal to noise for the next derivative, those of you who know about experiments would know that that's extremely difficult to do. We can do that for the next derivative now in about 1 month. And so here is a map of d2 idv squared with atomic resolution as a function of energy. Let's see, here's 40. So here comes the gap energy. And now we're outside the gap. And now here comes the electron boson interaction, but you won't notice it because it's so horribly disordered by the gap disorder. But the data sets exist. Many, many, many of them exist. So here's what we have to do. We go to each atom, let's say, and measure the density of states as a function of energy. Then we label the gap value at that location. And then we subtract that gap value from DIDV and take the next derivative. So there'll be a peak here, which is occurring at delta plus omega. After we subtract delta, this peak in d2 IDV squared will occur at a value of omega. So this axis now is the energy of the peak minus the local value of the gap. So it's the boson energy. And indeed, for every spectrum where this feature occurs, we can label the energy of this feature as a function of location. That's the practical achievement. It's particle Hall symmetric. The intensity isn't particle Hall symmetric, but the signature is particle Hall symmetric, as it's required to be in an Elie-Ashberg-style theory. So here's one of the maps of the surface. Here's a map of the superconducting energy gap, the pair energy in that field of view. And here's a map, simultaneous map, of that boson energy extracted by the procedure that I described to you. And you can see a couple of very interesting things already. One, the energy appears to be widely varying. There is a wide distribution. It's peaked around 52 millivolts. So no branch of a homogeneous phonon can have this property. It would be impossible. And secondly, the correlation length here is even shorter than here. It's like essentially one unit cell. It's like a different frequency in each unit cell.
Is it possible to measure the find from your study whether omega corresponds to localized oscillations or propagated oscillations?
Well, from the correlation function, the autocorrelation of this piece of information, it would have to be local because the value at one unit cell would be different than the next unit. Now, of course, if there was any impact of this boson on the superconductivity, there should be some correlation between the bosons and the pair energy. So if you look at these two pictures, you will probably suspect that there is little or no correlation between those two fields. But that'll be because your visual processing mechanism is dominated by the fact that the correlation length here is different than here. Actually, there is a strong correlation between those two fields. The pair energy is anti-correlated with the boson energy in this way. And this is true for all, we have done many of these experiments now. It's highly repeatable effect. So here's the pair energy as we change the hole density. 12%, very underdoped, high gap, optimally doped, intermediate gap, overdoped, low gap. And here's the simultaneous images of the boson energy. And this scale now is varying from 35 to 65 millivolts, with 50 millivolts being this horrible green color, if it is green. So one thing you notice is that the color here is changing from blue, black to red, whereas here it's changing from green to green to green. That already gives you an interesting piece of information. I'll show you the statistics. If we go for six different hole densities and we measure the distribution of gap values in those disordered images, at high hole densities, the gap value is low and has a narrow distribution. And as we go down in density, in carrier density, the gap value gets more and more and more widely distributed, and it goes to higher and higher values. That's exactly what everybody expects from studies of the superconducting electronic structure. I mean, the evolution to high gap value. So how about the simultaneous measure of the boson frequencies? It's completely independent of doping. And this is a non-trivial effect, because this means that here, the boson signature was at 20 plus 50, 70 millivolts, whereas here, the boson signature was at 55 plus 55, 110 millivolts. The absolute energy was changing dramatically. But after you do all the subtraction of these registered maps, you'll find out that boson is independent of doping. Now, what mode in a material like this, what bosonic mode would be independent of the carrier density? Well, a simple one, of course, is a crystal mode. Some crystalline degree of freedom, which has nothing to do with how many holes there are in the CuO2 plane. So, we believe there is a mode near 50 millivolts. It's strongly disordered at the nanoscale. It's doping independent, and it is well coupled to the signature of the superconductivity. And the question is it a lattice mode?
So the energy scale is consistent with the opposite?
Not perfectly consistent, but we don't believe that it's possible for the photo emission to measure the mode energy, because, on the nodal direction it is, and there it's reasonably consistent. In the antinodal direction, they're averaging over all the gap disorder. If you do that, you get the wrong energy for the mode. Okay, so there was a great deal of skepticism, you can imagine, when we tried to produce this result last year. So if the hypothesis is that this is a lattice mode, one can make a direct test by using an isotope effect.
Yeah. This little inset correlation plot.
I'll show you many of them.
Just to understand the implication of this is that if I were to make that correlation plot for a different sample, it would show a correlation, but it would be in a different place.
Yeah, great question. I wish I had published this graph, because that's a very common question. If I plot distributions of gap energy versus boson energy, at high doping, the distribution will be here. And as I go down in doping, the distribution will move up this scale. So they retain their correlation, but the centroid just moves off with doping. That implies that they're independent phenomena, of course. By they, I mean that the mechanism of superconductivity and the existence of the boson are independent phenomena. Okay. But now we need to identify this thing, and this is done by isotope substitution by our colleagues in SCUBA. And they substituted oxygen 18 for oxygen 16 throughout these crystals with very, very careful studies, really amazingly beautiful studies. They determined that they had done so by seeing the shifts in the appropriate Raman responses. For modes which you can detect by Raman in the crystal. None of this has anything to do with superconductivity at this point. It's just a demonstration that you substitute, say, 90 or 95% of the oxygen 16 by oxygen 18. Then they sent us the sample. We just FedEx. And if we take a picture, here's an oxygen 16 sample and here's an oxygen 18 sample, we see no difference in the quality of the crystals. They are equally superb, which doesn't surprise me. Now here's the topograph for oxygen 16. Here's the gap map, and here's the map of the mode energy. And here's topograph, gap map, and This is oxygen 16 and this is oxygen 18. So those of you who are familiar with looking at experimental data will try comparing this with that or this with that. Those are completely independent experiments, but they're statistically highly equivalent. There are no systematic errors in this scheme at the scale of what I'm reporting to. So if I make this correlation of pair gap energy to this mode frequency, I see this nice correlation for oxygen 16. So this is the mode frequency. So each dot here has its intensity representing the number of pairs of points that have the given same gap value and same mode frequency. And now if I substitute oxygen 18 in the sample, the mode frequencies move to the left. And the gap energy moved down. I'll come back to that in a second. That was a systematic error. But if I take the histogram of mode energies for oxygen 16, here it is, and the histogram of mode energies for oxygen 18, here it is, they are shifted from each other, and they're shifted down by 3.7. The 3 is knocked off the edge of this graph here, but it's 3.7 millivolts to the left, which is 6% of the mean mode energy, which is 1 minus the square root of 16 over 18. This is precisely what you would expect if you alter a lattice mode by changing the mass of the oxygen atom. There was a systematic error in this experiment. We didn't keep the two TCs the same, so we have repeated now. Here are two different crystals, same TC, same hole density, same style of experiment. This is the histogram for oxygen 16, and this is the histogram for oxygen 18. The histograms of gap values were unchanged, but the histogram of mode frequencies shifted again, as we expect, by 6%. So we're very, very confident that these features in the tunneling are coming from an electron lattice interaction, which is strongly interacting with the superconducting quasiparticles. But that interaction is almost local at the atomic scale. It's not a piece of a phonon branch. It's something local in the unit cell. So then the question people ask us is this feature in your experiment consistent with all of these photo emission experiments, which have been going on now for almost 10 years? So our colleagues again in SCUBA prepared samples. These are the same crystals as the ones I just showed you from our study, and had them studied in Hiroshima and in collaboration with Dan Dessau's group. To see, now the reason to do this work at Hiroshima is, unlike most of the light source photo emission devices where their energy resolution is about 10 millivolts, the Hiroshima machine has an energy resolution of about 1 millivolt. So it has enough resolution to see this classic isotope effect. So here is the cut for AK of omega along the nodal direction for oxygen 16 and oxygen 18. And you can see in the raw data that they are different. The isotope effect is seen directly in AK of omega if you have enough resolution. Here are the cuts as a function of energy at different wave vector. If you look carefully, you'll see they're different, but I can zoom in on one for you. And we see that the oxygen 16 and oxygen 18 are shifted from each other by about 3 millivolts in this range of energies where we're doing our experiment. When I first saw this graph, I was very, very worried, because the oxygen 16 feature is to the left of the oxygen 18 feature, which is the wrong direction. But they had labeled their energy axis pointing the other way. So it is a perfectly equivalent effect. The mode frequency reduction is in the 4 millivolt range for two completely independent techniques, provided they have enough energy resolution. So for us, this means that there is a mode, possibly a local mode, inside this CuO6 object, which I have been emphasizing. It's causing the effect on the superconducting states of the Eliasberg Scalapino type, and it's causing an effect here on the superconducting states of the Schrieffer Scalapino type, as detected by photoemission. But they're very disordered at the atomic scale. Nevertheless, they somehow retain their correlation. So there is a strong electron lattice interaction, but I do not wish to imply at this stage that we know its relationship to the mechanism. That really remains to be seen. If you like correlated theories, let's say the TJ model, then look at the physical structure in a textbook about the transition metal oxides, and of course you'll find that both T and J depend delicately on where the energy levels are in the oxygen atom. So you have to ask yourself whether some motion of the oxygen atom, or maybe some motion of the apical atom moving the energy levels, can do these things. And at present, the answer to that question is not known. But to come back to my original context, even supposing some strongly correlated theory can be written down to explain cuprate superconductivity, and there are many people who believe that was done long, long ago, if we want to understand the critical temperature, and if we want to drive these materials into a more useful regime, we also need to understand all these detailed solid-state physics out-of-plane effects. Thanks.